It hadn't been the door to the bathroom that had opened. It had been the door to his own bedroom. TJ was alone with Cheyenne. Griffin dropped the hot dog as well as the knife, although later he thought about how he should have taken it. He ran down the hall and flung open the bedroom door. TJ was leaning over Cheyenne. Her back was against the wall, her knees drawn up against her chest, making a barrier between them. Her eyes were narrowed in concentration, and her lips were pulled back from her teeth like a dog silently snarling. TJ had one knee on the bed and both of her wrists in one fist, pinioning her to the wall, and he was trying to take off Cheyenne's coat with the other hand. With a roar, Griffin launched himself forward. His fist landed on the side of TJ's head. TJ fell on the bed and rolled over on his back, howling. His cap had fallen off and slid down his skinny ponytail. "What the hell do you think you're doing, TJ?" Griffin shouted. He had been afraid of what TJ would do to Cheyenne, but he wasn't as worried about what TJ would do to him. TJ always knew when to put his tail between his legs, and right now Griffin was ready to kill him. Cheyenne scrambled off the bed. She tried to run for the door and fell when the cord around her ankle yanked her back. Griffin leaned down to help her up, and she clawed him. "It's me," he said, but Cheyenne still pushed him away and then got to her feet without anyone's assistance. She squeezed herself between the bed and the desk until her back was against the wall. She was panting, but she wasn't crying. Griffin suddenly thought that if he had brought the knife into the room, Cheyenne would have sunk it into both of them in turn, without a second thought.
"Just what do you think you're doing?"
"Look at her, all shiny," TJ whined. "I just wanted to take a little bit of the shine off. It's just like Jimbo says. She's so rich she probably wipes her ass with $20 bills. She probably thinks her crap doesn't even smell. I was just going to teach her a little lesson. Make her understand how the other half lives."
TJ was saying all this with snot running out of his nose. Griffin's hands were clenched into fists. He wanted to hit TJ again so bad.
"Say that again. What did Jimbo say?"
Something like hope played across TJ's face. He half sat up.
"Oh, you know, he was going on about how she probably thinks she's too good for us, and that she needed to be taken down a notch."
"And you listened to that BS?"
Griffin rubbed his fist. His middle knuckle was swelling.
"Get out, before I change my mind."
After TJ scuttled out carrying his hat, Griffin locked the door behind him. He pressed the button more for Cheyenne's benefit than anything else. He walked back and stood in front of her. She was trembling.
"It's okay. He's gone. I'm sorry I left you alone. I won't let that happen again."
With the tip of his index finger, he touched her cheekbone.
"I'm sorry."
Her shaking intensified, and he was afraid he had frightened her all the more. But when he tentatively reached out his arms, she put her face against his chest. Her breath smelled like orange juice. He held her tight and rocked her back and forth. It reminded Griffin of the one school dance he had gone to, when slow dancing just meant shuffling your feet. Just as he was getting used to the feel of her in his arms, Cheyenne stepped back. She pulled her coat into place.
"He was going to hurt me, rape me, maybe kill me. And I think he would have too if you hadn't come in. What kind of person could feel like I deserved that?"
Griffin sighed.
"Jimbo got him riled up. He likes to wind TJ up and watch where he goes. Out in the real world, nobody pays them any attention. To them, rich people aren't real. They're people in magazines and TV. Those two aren't around rich people very much."
He let out a little self-conscious laugh.
"Of course, I'm not either. But just like rich people would probably look at us and see white trash, those two don't think rich people are human either."
Cheyenne's next words were a surprise.
"What happened to your throat? The skin felt different there."
Griffin kept his answer short, letting his tone make it clear that he didn't want to talk about it.
It got burned.
How?
It was like she wanted to make him feel as vulnerable as she did.
In an accident.
What kind of accident?
My dad was cooking, all right?
Cooking?
He could hear the disbelief in her voice. Even Cheyenne had figured out that Roy would never cook anything.
My dad was making some meth, and a little of it spilled on a burner.
Meth? She didn't seem sure about what it was. Griffin envied her innocence.
Crystal, Tina, crank, ice. Basically, it's speed. Amphetamines. You used to be able to make it with stuff you could get at the grocery store. That's how my dad made extra money before they started locking up some of the ingredients. Then he lost his job and switched to stealing cars.
So, to make it, you have to cook it?
Yeah. It smells terrible, like cat piss. I went out to the barn to ask him something, and then when it flared up, I got burned on my throat and chest.
Griffin remembered how at first it had felt either really, really hot or really, really cold. He hadn't been able to tell which. And then suddenly it was hot, red hot, eating through him. He managed to rip off his shirt or he would have been burned even worse. The pain had been so great he had wanted to die or pass out. After a few seconds, he narrowed his choices down to just one. He wanted to die. He did neither. It was his mom who took him to the emergency room. His mom who made up some story about the wood stove. The doctors asked her to leave the room and then questioned Griffin about it again. He knew they didn't believe her. Griffin stuck to the same story. Not out of love for Roy, but because he was afraid his mom would get in trouble too. He had spent a month in the burn unit. IVs in the backs of both hands and a tube in his throat to help him breathe because the mucus lining had been burned too. Even with the tube down his throat, he had still been able to smell. The burn unit had been full of smells. The strongest came from the Silvadine salve, which was the color and consistency of Crisco and smelled like peppermint. Twice a day, the nurses spread it over his oozing burns. And underneath the Silvadine was another stench. Sweet and rotten. Every night, Griffin lay in the dark and listened to monitors beeping, ventilators whooshing, machines monitoring the thin threads of life. He heard other patients pleading, praying, screaming. Most of them frightened him. One was a homeless man who had been set on fire by bored teens. Another was a boy only a few years older than Griffin who had tried to kill himself by soaking his clothes with gasoline and lighting a match. And there was a little kid, 2 or 3 years old, who had tugged on the cord of a deep fat fryer and pulled it over on himself. One woman had been burned in a car accident. She had died on the third day he was there. In Griffin's nightmares, the nurses in their blue plastic gowns, rubber gloves, and paper bonnets were again wheeling him to the debridement room to scrub off his dead flesh with wire-bristled brushes. Even after his burns healed, he was reminded of them constantly. Every morning, his fingers traced the red, hairless scars when he soaped his chest and neck in the shower, or touched the shallower scars on the insides of his thighs where they had taken the skin grafts. Strangers stared at the shine of tight skin on his throat. Every touch, every stare brought it all back. The lights, the screams, the whispers, the smells. When he was out of the house, he wore his shirts buttoned up to the neck, but people still noticed the scars. His shirt collar didn't hide everything. And once people noticed, most of them couldn't stop staring, whether it was in a movie line or at the grocery store. Some looked at him and quickly looked away. Some pretended not to look, and then stared if they thought he hadn't noticed. And a few made a point of meeting his eyes and smiling, like he was some kind of a retard or a dog who might turn on them. He hated the smiles worst of all. Every day Griffin was in the hospital, his mother had visited him. And then one day, right before he was released, she didn't come.
"So I've been kind of wondering, where's your mom?" Cheyenne asked.
It was spooky, like she could read his mind.
What do you mean?
I mean, you live here with your dad, but you obviously had to have had a mom. So where is she?
She and my dad didn't get along,
Griffin said shortly.
So she moved back to Chicago. That's where she grew up.
She used to tell him stories about Chicago. About the lake in the summer and the wind in the winter.
Roy didn't like to hear them, so she only told them when he wasn't around.
When Roy finally came to visit Griffin in the hospital, he had told Griffin that his mom had left. She had fought with Roy about the drugs, said she had had enough, and she had left. Roy was expressionless when he broke the news. It wasn't until he got home that Griffin could see that his dad really had been experiencing emotions. First, anger. There was a great deal of broken furniture and dishes. And then despair. He hadn't cleaned anything up. Griffin had thrown away the shards, straightened up what was left, and gotten on without speaking about it, just as he had with his burns, just as he had when his mother never wrote or called. He had Googled her a few times at school, but the few Janie Sawyers he found were never the right age. Cheyenne was quiet for a long time. Then she said in a low voice,
"Do you think your dad will really let me go?"
"He says he will."
"That's not what I asked."
The truth was that with so much money at stake, Griffin wasn't sure how far he could trust what Roy said. If his dad did let Cheyenne go, if he left the actual doing of it to TJ and Jimbo, Griffin thought now that they might just take her into the woods instead and kill her. Rape her and kill her. Griffin realized the only one he trusted to let Cheyenne go was himself. He had to do it. Even if it meant risking everything, meant he ended up in prison along with Roy and TJ and Jimbo. The alternative was Cheyenne being murdered. He couldn't tell her, in case she somehow let it slip to the others. But when everyone was out getting the drop, he would take Cheyenne and go. When there was no chance that one of them would show up at the house and try to stop them, he would put Cheyenne in the truck and drive like hell until he could get someplace with a phone. Someplace with nice, bright lighting and lots of people. Where even if they caught up with him, TJ and Jimbo might think twice about killing them. And then he would turn her loose and go back and meet his dad, and they would go to Mexico or wherever. And he would hope that Cheyenne would keep her promise and not tell the police their names, and hope that the police didn't show up before he could get the hell out of there. Because if they did, they might decide he was one of the bad guys and kill him. Was he one of the bad guys? Griffin didn't know anymore.
23. Time to act. For the thousandth time, Cheyenne felt the face of her watch, making the tiniest of motions so she wouldn't wake Griffin. But now the time had finally come. It was 2 in the morning, the time she had decided to act. The afternoon and evening had dragged by. The 3 men had stayed in another part of the house, plotting, she presumed, their voices too low for her to hear. Griffin had mostly stayed with her, leaving only to get them something to eat. Cheyenne had catnapped, or pretended to. For one thing, she needed to be wide awake when the time came, and the more she slept, the more they would think she was sick and helpless, even though she thought she could feel the antibiotics kicking in. Sleeping, or pretending to, kept her from talking to Griffin, kept her from thinking that maybe she wouldn't do what she knew she had to. Miles from here, her father would soon be following instructions to drop off a black duffel bag stuffed tight with money, one that held no tracking devices or dye packs or anything else, or they would kill her. And her father was to come alone, with no one following him in another car or in the air or even with a computer, or they would kill her. Cheyenne knew all this because Roy had made her stand by while he repeated the details. Then he had pressed the phone into her hand long enough for her to choke out, "Daddy, please help me," before he snatched it back and pressed the off button. But it didn't really matter if her father did or did not follow the rules. It didn't matter at all. TJ had told Cheyenne as much when he attacked her. He had climbed on the bed and pinned her wrists against the wall and whispered in her ear.
Are you a virgin, Cheyenne? Are you? Because maybe it's time for you to become a real woman. Maybe you should let TJ give you a little lovin' before it's too late.
She had been too frightened to even make a sound. All she had done was shake her head violently, and one of her shakes had connected with TJ's nose. He had grunted in pain, and then his voice became even more oozing and vicious.
Where you're going, you won't be getting any loving. They never talk about getting it on in heaven, do they, baby? Let TJ give you a sweet memory to take to your grave.
Somehow, Cheyenne had mustered enough saliva in her mouth to spit at him. When he muttered a curse, she knew it had met its target. And then Griffin had stormed in and saved her. But saving her from a would-be rapist was one thing. Stepping in when Roy told TJ or Jimbo to take her for a ride was another. Would he defy these men, including his father, to save her? When saving her would make it much more likely that he would get caught? Wouldn't it simply be easier for Griffin to pretend to himself that they really were going to let her go? Sure, these men might get caught and go to jail for murder, but they might not. And they were all about short-term thinking. Take TJ. He had wanted to bring her down to his level, so he had groped and pawed at her, not even worrying about Griffin being in the next room. Cheyenne wished she had been able to reach her pocket before TJ had pinned her to the wall, wished she had used the broken piece of glass on him. She would have liked to have cut his throat. And she could have done it, too. What she didn't know was whether she could do what needed to be done now. The men had left several hours earlier, getting into position to make sure that her dad was following the rules. If they were going to come back to the house for something forgotten, they would have done it by now. It was time to act. Slipping her hand into her pocket, Cheyenne pulled out the piece of glass. Slowly, slowly, she crawled off the end of the bed. Griffin snorted and shifted, but then his breathing resumed a regular rhythm. She slid her feet forward until the cord that bound her ankle was taut as a wire. Bending down, she sawed through it in a few strokes. Her lungs ached, but she was too afraid to breathe except for the tiniest sips, too afraid she might cough. The slightest sound might give her away. When the cord parted, it was like taking a step into empty air. There was no turning back. If Griffin woke up, he would have to try to stop her. Gripping the piece of glass tighter, Cheyenne held her breath and listened. But he was still deeply asleep, exhaling audibly every few seconds. She tiptoed across the floor, testing each step. Putting her hand out for the knob, she found the door was not quite closed. It was a tiny thing, but still, it seemed like a good sign. She trailed her fingers down the wall of the hall until she reached the dining room. Pinkies leading the way, she ran her hands lightly over the table and what seemed to be a sideboard, but she found nothing more than dirty dishes. In the living room, on a rough wooden table, Cheyenne found what she was looking for. Her fingers traced the shape of it, and her mind supplied the picture. A big silver wrench. Heavy. She put the piece of glass in her pocket and then picked up the wrench and thwacked the end into her palm. If she hit Griffin hard enough, she could knock him unconscious. If she hit Griffin hard enough. And if she didn't, then he might wake up, might chase her down, might kill her. Cheyenne could feel her heart rate speeding up, her breath quickening. All that fight-or-flight response they had learned in biology. She turned and walked back down the hall. Outside the doorway, she stopped and listened. What if Griffin was awake and watching? What if she rushed him and he wrested the wrench from her hand and whacked her with it? Nothing but the sound of his deep, even breathing. She drew one last ragged breath and tiptoed toward him. Gripping the wrench in both hands, she raised it high overhead. Then, like a man splitting a log with an axe, Cheyenne swung the wrench in its swift and terrible descent. 24. Before they come back. Tears were still running down Cheyenne's face as she closed the bedroom door behind her.
Oh, God. Oh, God. She was pretty sure that she had just killed a man. A kid, really. Someone her own age. And the only person in this house who had treated her with kindness.
Cheyenne had meant to knock Griffin unconscious, but after she had hit him once, he had started up, yelling. Her heart had flopped in her chest like a fish. Without thinking, she had struck him again, much harder. He fell back on the bed. And after that, he hadn't moved. At all. She had dropped the wrench, wet now with his blood, on the floor. Forcing her feet to move, she staggered down the hall. If she didn't hurry, the men would come back and find her, and she knew they would kill her, especially now, after what she had done.
Oh, God. How long did she have? How long until they came back?
Cheyenne tried to distract herself by figuring it out. The drop had been planned for 3 in the morning, and they had wanted to make sure the money wasn't being traced or monitored in any way before they picked it up. Then they would drive back here and split it up. Now it was 2:12. Cheyenne figured she didn't have long, an hour, maybe two, no more. She had been around these men long enough to know that they would grow impatient, that their greed would trump any common sense. They wouldn't be able to watch that lonely bag of money for long before they decided they had to claim it. Before they came back here, she had to get as much distance as she could between herself and them. She wished she had Phantom. She thought of Duke, barking, lunging, big, clearly bought to scare people. Cheyenne felt a flash of unexpected sympathy. You couldn't always tell what something was by looking at the outside. In order to move with any speed, she would need something to tell her about obstacles. Her cane was a pile of melted rods inside the wood stove. What could she use as an emergency cane? While she had been lying awake, waiting for time to drag itself forward, Cheyenne had created a useless catalog of things they surely didn't have. Pool cues, ski poles, walking sticks, golf umbrellas. Now she forced herself to be practical. She would have to find a long branch, break it off, and strip it of twigs. And then Cheyenne realized what this place did have, in spades. Car antennae. She opened the front door and walked down the 3 steps. Earlier, her brain had automatically counted the stairs, just as it had the number of steps from the car to the house. The air was so cold it felt like it was pulling her lungs inside out. Her breath shook every time she exhaled, but she still wouldn't let herself think about what she had just done. Remembering that the yard had been littered with junk, she took short steps, feeling with each foot before committing her full weight. Her right arm was folded across her belly like a bumper, and she swung her left arm like a feeler. Cheyenne was alert to every sound, every smell, every bit of information. Her orientation and mobility instructors had tried to help her learn to use blind sight, a sense some blind people had of nearby objects and even their rough dimensions, but usually she relied on a cane or a dog to give her much more accurate feedback. After a minute or two, Cheyenne hit pay dirt. Her fingers grazed a fender. She felt along the edge of the car roof until she found the antenna. Then she snapped it off. At the sound, barking exploded from the barn. The chain rattled along the ground as Duke burst out and ran toward her. Cheyenne threw her left arm over her throat and braced herself. But the impact never came. About 15 feet from her, the barking suddenly ended abruptly with a choking sound. The dog must have reached the end of his chain. As soon as he got back on his feet, he started barking again. The noise made her wince. But there was no answering human sound. It was just the two of them, in the dark. Cheyenne took a deep breath, let it out, coughed for a few seconds, then got it under control. She had to forget about everything, ignore the dog, not think about Griffin, not wonder if he was dead. She had to focus on getting out of here before the men came back. Waving the antenna in front of her, she took a few experimental steps. It wasn't nearly long enough, and it was too flexible. Still, it was a lot better than nothing. Once she reached the woods, she could replace it with a long stick. She started off. Behind her, Duke whined, low in his throat. She realized he had stopped barking. She could hear his breathing. The sound reminded her so much of Phantom. Cheyenne turned. Not knowing if there was a moon out or how well the dog could see in the dark, she was careful to keep her face turned to the side so he wouldn't think she was challenging him with a stare. She kept still, with her arms at her sides.
"Good dog," she said.
She stretched each word out and kept her voice soft.
"Did I scare you? I didn't mean to."
Duke whined again. Cheyenne kept her words flowing, each one slow and soothing.
"Do you ever get tired of being on that big chain? Do you ever just want to get out of here? To be free?"
Her voice had been trembling, but now it strengthened. It was a crazy idea. But then, so was walking through the woods, whacking the underbrush with a car antenna.
"Do you want to just go? Do you, Duke?"
Very slowly, she reached into her coat pocket. Her fingers closed on a piece of kibble. With an underhand toss, she threw it in his direction. A yip let her know that she had spooked him. How many times had someone shied a stone at Duke? But he must have figured out it wasn't a stone, because next he made a curious little woof. The chain rattled, and she heard him whine as he strained forward. The kibble must be out of reach. She threw another piece. Another whine. On the third toss, a snuffle, followed by a gobble, told her that he had managed to retrieve it. He caught the next piece of kibble in midair. She heard the big jaws snap closed. Another low whine. Begging. Cheyenne wondered if Duke had ever begged before in his life, or if anyone would have listened if he had. With each bit of kibble, she took a step closer. Finally, she was close enough that she could feel his warmth. Making a fist of her hand, she held it out, still not certain that he wouldn't snap it off in a single bite. Instead, he sniffed. She felt the dampness of his cold nose, and then, incredibly, a warm, wet tongue. So Duke was a dog, after all, despite what everyone else thought. Moving with infinite slowness, Cheyenne placed the palm of her hand on his head. Duke trembled, but did not otherwise move or make a sound. She scratched behind one ear. When she moved her hand to his other ear, he pressed against her fingers, urging her to scratch right there, just as Phantom would have. She felt herself calming down, and she sensed that Duke was, too. Tracing their way down his neck, her fingers found the place where the heavy chain clipped onto the metal choke collar with a simple toggle. Could she walk him on the chain? She took a few steps away from Duke, letting the links play through her fingers. No, the chain was far too long and heavy. Then Cheyenne thought of her belt. She walked back to Duke and began to scratch his head again. Even though every bit of her screamed that she had to get out of here as soon as she could, she knew she couldn't hurry without risking spooking him. With her free hand, she undid her belt buckle. Awkwardly, she rolled it up one-handed, slowly slipping it loop by loop from her jeans. She didn't want Duke to see the belt loose, in case he felt threatened. Who knew if Duke had ever been whipped? Cheyenne amended the thought. She knew. All the while, she kept up a steady stroking with her other hand, tracing the shape of his head. Duke, with his short, flat fur, felt nothing like Phantom. Yet it was as if Phantom was with her now. When she had the belt free, her fingers tucked the end of it underneath Duke's collar. He whined, quivering under her touch, but otherwise didn't move. Threading the belt through the metal loop, Cheyenne pulled it until it became a makeshift leash. As if she were holding Phantom, she found herself taking her normal stance, her left leg ahead of her right, with the dog's head next to her left thigh. Then she held her breath as she unclipped the chain.
"Duke, forward," she said. "Come on, let's get out of here."
The dog whined deep in his chest but didn't move.
"Duke, forward," she said again.
"Hop up." Phantom would have known that meant she wanted to go fast, but what did Duke know? Then she felt him gather himself, and they were off. 25. The wind creates the trees. One thing Cheyenne hadn't thought about when she made her impulsive decision was that Duke wouldn't clear her. Phantom had been taught to watch out for low-hanging branches or other objects that might hit Cheyenne, even if they missed him. Duke had no idea. And neither did Cheyenne, at least not until she ended up with a deep scratch on one cheek. After that, she put her right hand up about a foot in front of her face, trying to gain a second's warning. Cheyenne had pointed Duke toward the woods, not knowing if he would follow her suggestion. But he had. She had felt him curve around the house and then head into the trees. The ground was crisp with frost, but with a springy softness underneath from decades of pine needles. Even knowing that daylight would bring far greater danger, Cheyenne found herself missing the little sight she had. Which way was Duke taking her? She could only follow the sway of the dog and listen to what her body told her. Her joints let her know whether she was going uphill or down, turning left or right. When you were sighted, you didn't pay attention to such messages because you didn't need to. When you were blind, you discovered your body had been saying these things all along. Now Cheyenne felt a branch brush the top of her head, but at least it hadn't gone through her head. Duke had led her around a tree, Cheyenne realized.
"Good dog," she said.
Duke made a noise low in his throat. It sounded like a question.
"Yes, you are a good dog."
She didn't know if that was the question, or if he was asking if he could trust her, or whether Duke wanted to know if they should keep moving. Cheyenne just knew that the answer was yes. They walked for a long time. It was slow going. Her shoes kept slipping off until finally she took the remnant of cord still tied around one ankle, cut it in two, and then threaded the pieces through the top holes of her shoes, tying each in a double knot. They went on, pushing their way through undergrowth, her feet catching on roots and downed branches. Sometimes she had to stop because she would start to cough and then not be able to catch her breath. The cold air seared her lungs. Hoping it would warm the air, she wrapped her scarf over her mouth and nose, leaving just her eyes uncovered. The wind was so cold it felt like it cut right through her, but it also helped her picture the outside world. She could hear the rustling of the trees now. In a way, the wind created the trees. Without the wind, it was like there were no trees at all, at least not until their branches scraped her face or arms. Occasionally, Cheyenne felt the face of her watch. By the time it got light, she hoped she might find the road that Griffin had told her about. Surely the men had returned by now, and they had found Griffin. She tried not to think about what she had done to him. And now they would hunt her down. As long as it was dark, she might have a slight advantage. The problem was that there was no way she and Duke were covering even 2 miles an hour, probably much less. It got a little easier as they went deeper and deeper into the woods. There seemed to be fewer bushes. The bottoms of her pants flapped stiffly. Soaked from pushing through undergrowth, so were her shoes. They kept plodding forward. Her legs were so tired they felt bruised, and her feet were frozen stumps. She tried to wiggle her toes and couldn't.
Was it starting to get light?
All she could see out of her left eye was a hazy grayness. Cheyenne checked her watch. It was a little after 7 a.m. Probably not yet, but soon. Duke whined. Cheyenne froze.
"What is it, boy?"
she whispered. She heard a rustle in the bushes to their left.
Oh, crap. This was it. They had found her.
Duke barked. Instinctively, she tried to put her hand over his snout, but he nipped at it. She jerked her hand back, surprised. For a moment, she had forgotten it was Duke she was with, not Phantom. Then several things happened at once. Straining forward, Duke unleashed a volley of barks. Something exploded from the bushes and ran right in front of them. Part of Cheyenne relaxed as she heard the underbrush rattle. Whatever it was small. Definitely not a person. Probably a rabbit or squirrel or maybe even a chipmunk. Still barking, Duke lunged after it. The belt jerked in her hand, and then it was gone. And so was Duke. "Come back!" Cheyenne shouted, suddenly frantic. "Duke! Duke!" She could tell from the pitch of his barking that he was running away from her, fast. He was already at least 100 feet away. Cheyenne opened her mouth to try calling him again. Then she realized that all she was accomplishing was to advertise her presence, probably for miles. Taking a deep, shuddering breath, Cheyenne told herself that she was on her own now. That was a fact, and she couldn't change it. Only deal with it. She touched her watch face. It was 7:33. She was pretty sure that they had been traveling roughly northwest. The grayness she could see with her left eye was just getting lighter. Using the trunk of a tree to orient herself, she slowly turned in a circle until she confirmed that east, where there was more light, was where she thought it was. Crouching, Cheyenne groped until she found several long branches. She picked the longest and sturdiest, and then snapped off the smaller twigs. It was hard work. Her right hand was stiff with cold, and her left hand, the one that had been holding the makeshift leash, refused to move much at all. She brought it up to her cheek. It felt as if a branch was brushing her face. Her cheek could feel her icy fingers, but not the other way around. The bottoms of her pants now had a crackly coating of ice. After several long minutes, the branch was free of twigs. It wasn't a dog, and it was barely a cane, but it would have to do. When Cheyenne finally straightened up, her knees had locked. She staggered forward a few steps. She couldn't feel her feet or the tops of her ears. Her left hand was in her pocket, but it still felt dead and stiff. And now her right hand was slowly freezing, making it hard to hold the makeshift cane. Cheyenne continued to tap her way forward, turning her head from side to side, alert for the sounds that reflected back to her, trying to sense objects before she ran into them. Sometimes she just missed a tree or bush at the last moment. Sometimes she tripped over stones or roots. Without the company of Duke, Cheyenne was aware of how alone she was. Every sound made her freeze. Could there be large animals in these woods? Coyotes? Or even mountain lions? But the animals that really scared her were the two-legged ones. A crow exploded out of the bushes ahead of her, and she cried out at the sound of its harsh call, the flap of its wings. Every creak or rustle behind her was one of her kidnappers. Each time she heard a noise, Cheyenne took a deep breath and forced herself to keep moving forward, trying to make her steps as light as possible. She walked with her head turned to one side, straining to use her left eye as she never had before. Now that it was lighter, she could see just enough to keep from blundering into tree trunks, but not enough to avoid low-hanging branches. Her chest ached, and every few minutes she found herself coughing. Each time it was harder to stop. She wanted to lie down. If you froze to death, didn't you just go to sleep and never wake up? That way, it wouldn't even hurt. The idea seemed appealing. A tiny cold dot landed on her cheek, then another in her eyelashes. Snow. It fell faster, softly freckling her face. At home, she hated snow. All her familiar markings, the different textures of grass and gravel, asphalt and concrete, were obliterated. If the snow was deep enough to cover the curb, she had to stay home because she couldn't tell one block from another. Here in the forest, the snow presented a different problem. Soon, with every step, Cheyenne would leave a footprint. And then it would be a simple matter for them to track her down. 26. Coming closer by the second. Cheyenne had been walking by herself for about half an hour when she heard something moving in the woods behind her, not making any effort to be quiet. And this time there was no doubt as to what it was.
A human. And coming closer by the second.
Panicked, Cheyenne began a blundering search for shelter. She found a clutch of something that still had leaves, some kind of low bush. Pushing aside branches, she scrambled in. She paid no attention to how it scratched her face and neck, or the wetness that soaked through to her knees. And still, when she was in as deep as she could get, she wondered if her silver coat was shining through a thin patch, or if her shoe was sticking out. The footsteps came closer and stopped. She could hear someone's harsh breathing, a man's. She knew it wasn't a lost hunter, and it certainly wasn't someone come to rescue her, or they would have been calling out for her. That left only three choices. But which of the three men was it? Roy, TJ, or Jimbo? And did it really matter? Or would she be dead no matter who it was? She remembered TJ's rank breath when he straddled her. Maybe the real horror would be how long she was alive before she was dead. It was so hard to hold absolutely still while every molecule of her being screamed that she should run away. How much snow was on the ground? Did her footprints lead straight to her like an arrow? She was barely breathing. And then Cheyenne felt it. A cough, forcing its way out of her throat. Her eyes watered. She bit her lip. She couldn't cough. She couldn't. A cough would be her death sentence. The coppery taste of blood washed across her tongue as she bit down harder and harder. Then the cough pushed its way up out of her chest, tore through her throat, and shattered the silence. And the footsteps charged toward her.
No! Cheyenne screamed. No, no!
Strong arms lifted her off her feet, and a calloused hand went across her mouth. She struggled, kicking and flailing, but all she did was tire herself out, and she was already so tired.
Cheyenne, a voice said. Shh, shh, calm down.
Griffin?
She started to cough again. He dropped his arms and stepped back, leaving her standing. Cheyenne coughed so hard that she staggered sideways. Finally, she managed to gasp,
"You're alive!"
In a weird way, it was a relief to know she hadn't killed him.
"No thanks to you,"
his voice was matter of fact. The reality of her situation set in.
"Oh,"
Cheyenne said, "right. They sent you out after me, didn't they?" She realized there was no use running anymore, no use fighting. She had done her best. She had done more than she had ever thought possible. But it hadn't been enough.
"Go ahead," she said. "Do what you have to do."
She took a deep breath and braced herself.
"What are you talking about?" Griffin asked. "Go ahead with what?"
Cheyenne didn't understand why he was stretching this out. He must want revenge for her attack.
"You're going to shoot me, right? Just get it over with."
"Why do you think I'm going to shoot you?"
"Oh, don't pretend. TJ told me I was going to die. You guys have to kill me so I can't lead the cops back to you."
She swallowed. In a few more seconds, she would break down and start to beg, and that's how she would die, begging and choking on her own blood.
No, she wouldn't.
She tried to make her voice light, as if this wasn't really happening. Maybe she could pretend right up until the very end.
"So go ahead. Do what you need to do. Just make it fast."
She took a deep breath and then closed her eyes so that she was in complete blackness. She tried to picture her mother's face.
I'm coming, Mom. There was a long silence. When it was broken, it was not by a gunshot, but by Griffin's voice, weary and disappointed.
I'm out here trying to help you, not kill you. I came after you on my own. But I don't think TJ and Jimbo and my dad can be that far behind, so we've got to get out of here as fast as we can. Get to the road, flag someone down for help, and go to the cops.
Wait, you came out here to help me? After what I did to you?
When I first woke up, I was pretty pissed off. I've got a bloody bump on top of my head the size of an egg, and it throbs every time my heart beats.
Griffin's voice was tinged with bitterness.
I was actually planning on helping you get away. If you had given me a few more minutes, my alarm would have gone off. I didn't tell you because I didn't know if I could trust you not to let it slip. Besides, part of me couldn't believe they would really do anything that drastic. Not really. But then after you hit me with that wrench, I realized that everyone is capable of violence, even you, even my dad, and that I was naive to think that they would really let you go. So my choices were to sit at home and wait, or to find you and help you escape. You know, wandering alone out in the woods in the middle of a snowstorm when you're blind and have pneumonia is not a really good escape plan.
He let out a long, exasperated sigh.
How could you really believe that I'm some stone-cold killer?
What about that gun you held to my head in the car? Remember?
Oh, that.
His voice sounded oddly embarrassed.
That wasn't a real gun.
Not a real gun.
Well, then what was it?
That was actually the cigarette lighter from the dash.
Cheyenne remembered the circle of cold metal pressed against her temple.
A cigarette lighter?
She had been so scared.
Sorry.
He took her arm.
Come on, we better start moving before they catch up with us. You can tell the cops that I helped you, and that I never meant for this to happen.
Cheyenne didn't move.
Won't you get in a lot of trouble?
I think it's a little bit late for me to be thinking about that. I'm already in trouble. It's just a matter of how bad, so let's get going.
27. Face the facts. 2 hours earlier, Griffin had woken up with one hell of a headache. The alarm was buzzing, and he had a blurry feeling that it had been going off for a while. Before he had lain down beside Cheyenne, he had set the alarm for 2:30. He was sure it wouldn't be necessary, that he would be too keyed up to sleep. And that was his last waking thought. Now the clock said it was 3:12 a.m. He sat up. A wave of dizziness crashed over him. His head ached something fierce. When he put his hand to the top of his head, it came away wet and sticky. At the sight of the red on his fingers, he felt a muzzy sort of shock. He explored the wound more gingerly. Two welts, one an inch longer, right next to each other. The skin around them was swollen tight. But no broken bits of bone when he probed, grinding his teeth together against the pain. Pushing himself into a sitting position, Griffin tried to figure out what had happened. He was on the bed, in his sleeping bag. He looked to his left. The nylon cord was still tied to the empty bed, but there was no Cheyenne on the end of it. And on the floor was a big silver wrench, one end clotted with something. He felt a little sick when he looked at the reddish-brown clump, matted with hair. That was blood. His blood. Griffin got up. For a second, he had to steady himself on the bedpost. He wasn't going to make the same mistake he had last time. He wasn't going to go rushing outside only to leave Cheyenne in the house. He quickly went from room to room, opening all the closets and looking underneath the furniture. The fire in the wood stove had gone out, and the house was quiet and cold. No Cheyenne. This time, she really had to be in the woods. He yanked on a coat, hat, and gloves, then grabbed the flashlight and went looking for her. And then he discovered Duke was gone, too. To follow their trail, he had been forced to move slowly, scanning back and forth with his flashlight, looking for a footprint in the dusting of snow or freshly broken branches. Once it got light, Griffin knew it would be easier. For everyone. He had been determined to find her before the others did. Now he walked beside Cheyenne through the forest. Even though it was daylight, it was the time of year when even at noon the light was gray and uncertain. Scarves of mist clung to the trees. Sounds carried oddly here, floating through the cold, crisp air, making it hard to pinpoint where they came from. Even though he was hurrying as fast as he could, it was still slow going as they skirted mud holes and underbrush. At least the snow was lighter here, just a spotty dusting, so they didn't have to worry about leaving tracks. There wasn't enough clear space for them to easily walk side by side, so while Griffin carefully steered Cheyenne across relatively unlittered ground, his own feet scuffed through ferns or got sucked in by half-frozen mud. When his foot was wrenched from under him, Griffin screamed. He couldn't